Call to order the Joint Legislative Task Force on County Payments. Today is Friday, January the 20th, 2012, and I want to welcome everyone. Thank you for this nice group that has come together. This is a critical issue, and by your presence, you have shown us that you share in that opinion. We have a great agenda today, but we want to move rapidly, and so I'd like to invite Michael Jordan to the table so that you can give us your report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the task force. For the record, I'm Michael Jordan. I'm the state's chief operating officer and the director at the Department of Administrative Services. My job here today is just to give you a little bit of background and kind of frame on the issues from the state and county perspective. We've done a lot of work in the last few years. The history on this issue is long. I know many of you know a lot about this, so I'm going to try and move pretty fast. And again, let you get through your agenda, but certainly leaving time for questions and perhaps some discussion. So you have before you, I think, three handouts that I will mention from time to time through my remarks. The first of which is a diagram that kind of shows the recent history on county payments since the year 2000. It looks like this. And it marks the first adoption of the Secure and Rural School Act back in 2001, and then charts the history up to today regarding the notion of county payments. But the history on this goes clear back to the 1930s in various forms of legislation at the federal level regarding the relationship between counties in this country and their financial ability to support themselves and their lack of ability really to assess taxation upon large tracts of federal land within their jurisdictions. And so that history is long. So this gives you some reference as to the recent history and the timelines. Most recently, under the Kulongoski administration back in 2007, there was discussion about this issue in anticipation of potentially county payments ending in 2008. The task force was formed. It was cross-jurisdictional, multi-stakeholder, represented state agencies and counties, even a city representative on that, and other interests. They came out with 53 recommendations. They fell into a number of categories, but altogether, they would have, had they all been adopted, would have replaced somewhere between 90 to 106%, depending on the county, of the payments that were coming to counties at that time. However, about 50% of that replacement would have relied on recommendations around federal timber management, federal land management. So they weren't all around how does the state and the county and cities either get the ability to raise more revenue or reallocate efforts so that we could provide services to citizens just from, let's say, inside the state of Oregon resources. They, again, 50% of those had to do with the management of forest lands. Counties have made significant efforts in varying degrees. One of the challenging characteristics of this issue for us is that every county is in a slightly different situation. They have different portfolios of tools for revenue. They obviously have different tax capacities in each of these counties. There are different relationships between the county and their cities, different levels of intergovernmental relationships between a particular county and its surrounding counties. And so each county is practically a unique situation to try and come at regarding how do we deliver services to the citizens within that county. And so it makes it a particularly challenging problem for us to get at. I know that having been a county commissioner in Clackamas County and worked on the first bill back in 2001, I know that there is a bit of a constant discussion about counties should have seen this coming. Haven't they done something to take care of this issue? They should have seen it coming. And to be honest, counties have done a lot of things over the years in varying degrees in all of those categories that I just mentioned. Developing intergovernmental relationships with other counties, forming different kinds of districts to deliver services. And one of their real challenges, quite frankly, is just before the payments started in 2002, we had a change in our constitution regarding the property tax in the forms of Measure 47/50, which froze counties' ability to change their property taxes except for local option levies and the formation of completely new taxing entities with a new permanent rate. We find ourselves today, for the counties who have been able to put those extra levies on, we find ourselves today in a situation, given the downturn in the economy since 2008, we now find ourselves in many rural counties where the real market value of property has now dropped below the assessed value of that property, and the compression from Measure 5 that occurs is starting to occur more and more across wider and wider landscapes within particularly rural counties. And so the first thing to go in that situation are those local option levies. They get compressed first under our Constitution and the way Measures 47 and 50 work. So,
Jordan, I want to interrupt and stop you just for 1 minute and ask Beth if she'll make an announcement. There are a number of people that have come in.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure everyone knows that if you would like to, that there is, this meeting is being streamed down in the Senate gallery, so there's additional seating, and you can watch and hear everything. It's on the TV down there.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Jordan.
No problem. I'd like to point out, just for your information, there are two separate sheets, which may be labeled as handout number two to you. They list the counties that receive payments, and this chart can be a little bit confusing, so I just want to make sure everyone understands it. What this really shows in the bar graphs are the percentage of loss to the funds that go to both the general funds of these counties on one sheet and on the other sheet to their road fund. And you'll notice certainly there are significant drops, particularly at the top, about 10 counties. But if you look at those two lists and look at where in about the top 10 or 12 counties, where there's a common name in both lists, you can see where the severity really hits the ground hard in some of these counties, particularly Douglas, Curry, Lane, Grant, Klamath, are ones that appear in the top 10 of both those lists. So it can give you some sense of the severity of the situation, relatively speaking, regarding these two measures, I guess, of severity. After the task force that was put together under the Kulongoski administration and those recommendations came forward, a number of those recommendations found themselves into legislation. And your third handout has those 53 recommendations listed. They're categorized under kind of full implementation, so which ones have we already implemented, which ones have been partially implemented, and then which ones have there been really no action on to date. And you can see those for yourself. It also lists underneath them the reference for the legislation if that's what was put in place to implement them. Subsequent to this, back in 2009, another committee, the Task Force on Effective and Cost-Efficient Service Provision, chaired by Representative Nathanson, came out in 2010 with 23 more recommendations regarding county payments under the kind of the broader rubric, if you will, of collaboration between state government and county government, and how could we I think, if I can use my own description, how can we give broader latitude to counties to be able to either more cost-effectively provide services, a greater level of flexibility regarding intergovernmental collaboration, and potentially even how can they restructure themselves and some discussion there. So another 23 recommendations came out in 2010. Quite frankly, not many of those made it through legislative process in 2011. I think the fiscal constraint that that 11 session had on it, whenever these things had a fiscal associated with them, and they may have made them their way to Ways and Means, they didn't make it very far past that, for the most part. Some of them were implemented, but not very many. I want to... As I close, Governor Kitzhaber has been fairly clear regarding his position on county payments. Probably first and foremost, and not very encouraging, is that the state is not in a financial position to be able to just backfill the money. I think that's probably the strongest message. However, the governor and I know the staff stand ready to collaborate with counties. We are working with the Association of Counties. I've had meetings with county commissioners from Curry County, particularly, and I also know that the governor is supporting the Oregon Solutions Project down in Curry County to try and bring citizens together, excuse me, and work their way through what are the potential recommendations to go to the county commissioners. My understanding that process, excuse me, is going to produce a set of recommendations that are going to go to the county commissioners February 1st or shortly thereafter. And thank you. And we stand ready to try and collaborate on potentially statutory tools if that's what's necessary, and working with them through structural changes or intergovernmental agreements to try and make sure that services can be delivered to citizens. We are providing technical assistance. I have a number of staff in my office that are doing research on possibilities. We are connecting with the Department of Justice where there may be legal impediments on some of these tools and trying to get opinions about what we can and what we cannot do. I'll stop talking for a moment and potentially take questions.
Thank you very much. I want to take this opportunity to welcome the task force today. I didn't do that before I gaveled in, so I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair, Senator Johnson, and ask the first question, if you would allow me to do that. I'm going to take advantage of your experience as a county commissioner, because I think that you have an ability to see this from the inside and both sides of the table. And your comment on flexibility really got my attention. And I wonder, as a county commissioner and in looking at counties today, if you feel that they are just hamstrung in too many ways, both by their ability to have intergovernmental relations, but also their ability to spend the money that they do get. And if you'd comment on that, please.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. There certainly are restrictions on most of the flows of money that come to counties in their role as agent of the state. So human services money that gets passed through, to some degree, the public safety money that comes through. There are certainly strings on that money. It's very... I hate these questions because the answer is always is, it depends. There is a significant amount of flexibility for counties and cities to collaborate under the law. It's not easy to do. As anybody who served in local government knows, it is a difficult chore to formulate intergovernmental relationships for the delivery of a service, and allocating the costs of those services is always a challenge. But there is authority for local governments to do many things that they're not doing today. There are political barriers to doing that. And let me say lastly, I don't think we are cognizant enough of the varying capacity of counties to be able to fund their own issues. Is there an obligation of local citizens to carry a share of those services? Absolutely. Is there also a role for the state to be cognizant of the capacity of those counties to be able to do that over the long term? I think there is. And so our job, I believe, together, partnering, is to find out how we put the right combination of tools in place to be able to get every county to prosper. And that's not an easy chore, much easier said than done. But I can tell you that the governor and the staff at the state stand ready to try and work with counties to figure out, A, how do we develop more broad solutions, perhaps more permissive solutions that allow them to be more flexible, but perhaps more importantly, work with them as service delivery partners. And I want to emphasize that partners, we haven't always been perceived each other as partners in the past. We need to enhance that relationship to try and optimize that service delivery in what are unique characteristics in practically every county, which is going to be a huge challenge.
Senator Jones.
Thank you. I'd like to drop down now into the weeds. And I appreciate the governor's willingness to say that his office will be flexible in trying to work through some of these problems. And I know that that has a huge impact, the governor's convening authority. What I'm trying to look at is working sort of individual problems. And at our first meeting and the last meeting that we had, there was a discussion about Curry County in particular and the fact that there is the possibility that might involve a large land swap that would facilitate a golf course and resort, unlike Bandon Dunes, going ahead. But it's going to involve a lot of state agencies. What I'm trying to figure out is, so we don't look like a box of mice somebody tipped over, what is the portal of entry into that system? And I say this respectfully because there are legislators in this room that represent that neck of the woods. But if they're going to start working these individual problems, what is the logical portal of entry for legislators to be helpful in facilitating the enormous power of the governor's office to bring people together to try to figure out what's in the realm of the doable?
On the particular case, I don't know the actual port of entry. I realize that was a parks land question and a swap issue, and I know that the Parks Commission was probably the venue that that dialogue would begin. So on that particular one, I think that's the case. The broader answer to your question for legislators is that we are attempting through Greg Wolf's office to try to coordinate agency interfaces with counties, particularly Curry in this case, to try to work with state agencies on one side and the Association of Counties on the other to be the place where the clearinghouse can be on these particular processes. So service by service, agency by agency, if you will. So I would say, just off the top of my head, and I know Greg's in the room, he may be scowling at me for saying this, but I think his office is going to be the clearinghouse for this. Secondarily, I know my office is working really hard on the research and technical support side. So I would invite any legislator working through Greg or my office, if you have a particular interest on a particular service, we can be the clearinghouse for the information on that.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I have to admit to being a bit of an evangelist for the regional solutions process, and that might be the logical place to begin with the directors that are on the ground to at least flesh out the proposals in some way that can be brought to the attention of the governor's office, because I think the people that represent specific geographic areas are in all likelihood the most knowledgeable about what the complexities are and where the impediments might arise in terms of permitting or regulatory impediments. But I think that using county commissioners and legislators on the ground in a meaningful way to get to the kind of help that you're offering from the governor's office would be very useful, a kind of streamlined, this is the path, and if it is regional solutions, articulate that in a way that, that everybody knows.
Thank you,
Co-Chair
Senator.
Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, you've been involved in this from a number of directions. You have fiscal acumen, obviously, because of your position. You've been really clear, and I think from a ways and means perspective, for those of us who are sitting there, we know we're not just going to fix this problem when Curry County in June comes insolvent and says, fix this for us. We just don't have the revenue to do that. Having said that, and this not being a political problem, it's a math question. It's a question of harvest level. So you can easily say from the governor's office, we can't backfill the funding. What can you tell us about the governor's office position of support for more aggressive harvest?
Madam Chairman, Representative Hanna, I'm not the appropriate person probably to answer that question in detail. I think Richard Whitman's in the room and could answer it for you if you'd like to follow up. But I can tell you that the governor's actively working with the delegation on legislation that exists, as you know, in both houses right now, trying to work with them on something that is a practical way to move forward on forest land management in this state. And I think the governor's committed to that. He's been in D.C. working with the delegation and meeting with the administration on these issues. So again, I think Richard could give you a more detailed answer, but I know he's supportive of legislation to change the management of forests in Oregon.
May I follow up?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to pin you to a policy position.
Okay.
Like I say, I think it's a math issue. So there, like me, I'd sit down and do the math and say how many board feet's going to take to harvest in that county to make the county whole over a period of time. I'm just asking the question because likely going to come through your shop where somebody at the county level is going to say, hey, Michael, for my county to survive, I need a harvest rate that's at this level, and the math says at this level times the board feet times whatever the revenue is, there we go. So I'm not putting you in a position of being a policy person. I just want to hear that because to my benefit, and I think there's people in the room who I believe have that benefit, they're saying to ourselves, we're having this whole conversation about fixing an emergency based on the fact that we're not getting the harvest level that makes the math work. So we can talk about this for a long, long time, and I'm sorry, but this continues to frustrate the heck out of me, that we're talking about fixing things and funding flexibility, and so I have to say that. This is about harvest. So let me ask my next question, if I may.
Follow up.
The funding flexibility piece. We have had, and I know we've sat in the room, many of us, and had this conversation around funding flexibility, i.e., those funds which flow directly to transportation, public safety, education. Some counties have an option for moving transportation money into their public safety, for patrol, those kind of things. But then we also, in our last meeting, and this group has looked at the shared services. So we went through a list of items. You were with us and said, here's all the things we share services. My question about flexibility and a place that I want us to explore jointly is when we talk about prioritized pooling of funds, Do you feel like there will be a great deal of flexibility there? In other words, and not to pick on public safety, but to give an example, if you had a county like Curry County and they had X amount of dollars for public safety and the state were spending X amount of dollars through public safety in OSP, and we said, gee, the best use of public safety dollars are, do you feel like we're going to be able to say through the executive branch, hey, let's have this conversation. If you have public safety through OSP over there, it's going to be on state highways. The only two police forces would be Wayne, Brookings, and Gold Beach, I think, right? So are we going to have a conversation around how do we flexibly best spend those dollars? And the other question will come up in elections, and we've had a conversation with our Secretary of State. We got to get pretty darn creative.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I think that conversation is long overdue.
Okay.
I think every one of our delivery systems has to be re-examined from the appropriation to the unit of service delivered to a citizen on the ground, and we have to think very creatively about how we invest across that delivery system. If the Superintendent of State Police was sitting here right now to your question, he'd be saying we better sit down and think about how to do this because nobody's got enough resources to do it by themselves. And so we have to think about how we're applying those resources more effectively.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Other questions? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, I'm not necessarily asking for an answer because you're not the policy guy here, but I'm looking at the recommendations and the no action one. Recommendation number 49 is transfer ONC lands to state management. And under the provision of the fact that the federal government has no right to own land in the state of Oregon because we never gave it to them, I think this is probably something worth pursuing. And this is probably more of a question for Mr. Whitman, and you can get back to me at a future time, Richard. But all the states around us granted the authority of the federal government to come in and own the land. We did not. So to a degree, the federal government is squatters in the state of Oregon. And I think that is definitely something worth pursuing.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For your report. We're going to move on now. We have a presentation by a group. I'll call them up. Bob Ragon, Ray Wilkerson, Jim Geisinger, Nancy Hathaway. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here today.
Yes.
I really look forward to having you in.
I was going to be in Coos Bay last night and drive up this morning.
Oh.
I changed my plan.
Yes, I think you should. I think you should.
Co-Chair Berger, Hannah, and Roblin, and members of the task force. My name is Bob Ragon. I'm Executive Director of Douglas Timber Operators in Roseburg, Oregon. And the rest of the panel is...
I'm Nancy Hathaway, President of Oregon Small Woodlands Association.
Jim Geisinger with Associated Oregon Loggers.
Ray Wilkerson with Oregon Forest Industries Council.
I'm going to go first because I'm the oldest. I seem to be, it just works that way most of the time. But it is timely that we have this discussion. We appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation to you. And it really follows up on a speech that that Governor Kitzhaber gave to the Board of Forestry back in Forest Grove a couple months ago. And basically the focus of his speech was the fact that our forests are really being managed in kind of like little fiefdoms. We have private lands, we have state lands, we have federal lands, but we have one of the big elephant in the room is our federal forest lands, which are not being managed, and obviously that's the reason we have the issue today with county payments. Our focus of this presentation, we'll be talking about kind of give you an idea of the magnitude of the problem, explain why it's important to private landowners and others that we manage our federal forest lands, and then to talk about, in general, some solutions that are being considered by Congressman DeFazio, Schrader, and Walden, legislation that we hope to be introduced fairly soon, that they've been working hard for a number of months on. We know some of the details. There have been several newspaper accounts about them, but we don't have the final details, and certainly you don't either. So our ask was going to be about a resolution in support of that legislation, which until we see it, it's kind of hard to do that. So at the tail end of this presentation, Doug Robertson and Kim Krause, Doug representing the ONC counties and Cameron representing Swanson Group, are going to talk about what exactly our ask is. I entitle my remarks The Magnitude of, I'll keep it, Beth, help me here. Oh, look at that. That's us. The Magnitude of Our Federal Forest Dilemma. I want to touch first on a report that was done by Governor Kulongowski back in 2006-2008, Federal Forest Advisory Committee report. As we were headed down the pike of seeing the end of the county payments, the governor recognized and his staff that we were headed for a train wreck. What can we do to get the federal forest more productive? The report is a summary of recommendations by a group that met numerous times for the governor to engage federal recommendation for the state of Oregon to engage federal forest managers in attempting to break the gridlock that stymies management of our federal forests in Oregon. While the report was timely for 2008, it is behind the curve now for a whole host of reasons. One of the things that the report did not address, which is a key element, and that is how to break the legal gridlock that that surrounds everything that the National Forest and the BLM agencies try to work with. As an example today, the Medford BLM district, which is probably one of our timber poorest sites in western Oregon, Out of 18 timber sales that were put up, 17 were protested. A protest for the BLM is the beginning of the appeal process, is the beginning of litigation. So we have not addressed, at this point in time, the report itself does not address litigation and how to deal with it. These are the other reasons that that report, in my view, are out of date. The recession that started in 2007 continues unabated with double-digit unemployment in most rural counties. County payments have been receiving federal county payments that have done little to reduce unemployment. Because of the federal deficit, renewal of secure school legislation is very problematic. We need a solution that is permanent and tied to long-term management of our federal forests, providing not only revenues, but jobs. Curry County's on the verge, which you guys all have been talking about with Josephine and Lane, which will be interesting when that one tips over, counties. Infrastructure in our industry continues to lose further ground, especially in Eastern Oregon and Southwest Oregon, with just 10 operations available for all of Eastern Oregon. Private forest land owners in Eastern and Southwest Oregon have lost markets for their logs, leaving them with no opportunity to manage their lands for income. Forest health in the National Forest in Eastern Oregon continue to decline, and the Forest Service is not capable of getting ahead of that mortality. Fire danger from federal lands is a threat to privately held forests, and we don't have time for more studies or collaborative efforts. We need solutions now, here and now, not only does the industry, but also our counties. I'll start with who owns the forest. I've used this presentation in a number of different venues, particularly with the Elliott State Forest. I'd like to point out, this is a bar graph of acres within the state of Oregon. The total is 26 million acres of forest land in the state of Oregon that is deemed suitable and appropriate for managing for timber harvest. And I'd like to point out that the largest landowner here is U.S. Forest Service with 12 million acres. And this is an apples-to-apples comparison. Wilderness areas, congressionally withdrawn areas, national recreation areas, lakes, ice, rocks, mountains are not included in that. So that's what the Forest Service deems as land that's suitable for growing trees. The timber industry has 6 million acres. The state of Oregon manages almost 800,000 acres. That would principally be the Tillamook and the Elliott. Small woodland owners are a major source of ownership of forest land, 4.7 million acres. The Bureau of Land Management, which is what we're talking about today, ONC counties and county payments, 2.2 million. The Forest Service, 12 million. Now, this is what the harvest is that comes off those lands. Was an average from 2004 to 2008. So it's high markets and low markets. A total of the harvest is 4 billion feet. The industry was 2.9 billion, 73% of the volume. They own 23% of the land and provided 73% of the volume harvested. The other particular issue here are these two categories, the BLM and U.S. Forest Service. Together, they harvested less than 9% of this total harvest, yet they own 61% of the forest. So that is the problem right there. The 9% of the forests that are 61% of our available forests provide any kind of harvest level. Another way to equate this to numbers, which are always simpler than some of the other ways to talk about forests, kind of a benchmark for growing forests in Oregon is 600 board feet per acre per year. If you manage your forest pretty well, you can do that. Some forests exceed that on the coast where we have higher site land. Some are lower. The timber industry average harvest level per acre was 486,000 board feet per acre. That number is 85% of what we're growing. And the reason it's not 100% is because we have reserves for streamside buffers, for owls, for various other things. The Department of Forestry, with state forests of Tillamook and the Elliott, harvest about 60% of what they're growing. And that's what we saw in the Elliott, was a harvest level of about 60% of what the forests were capable of growing.
We reached down to the BLM Forest Service. The BLM is harvesting about 8% of what's growing on the BLM lands, and the Forest Service is harvesting about 5%. There's no other easier way to compare it than just say we are receiving no management from our federal lands, and it's primarily because of legal gridlock. And until legal gridlock is addressed, we won't receive any management from our federal lands. Just to show you another slide to illustrate where we've been and why we're in trouble is this shows the harvest level in Western Oregon for the last 20 years. And you can see where we've fallen off from a level of about 1.5 billion board feet down here today to about 200 million board feet. And, you know, we had the Federal Forest Advisory Committee report developed in 2008 and really has no way to correct this problem. There's no way to address the issue of legal gridlock. This is the Forest Service. This is the states of Oregon and Washington for that same period. And the trend is identical. And what this amounts to is not only lost payments to the counties, it's lost jobs and thousands of them. And family wage jobs in the mills, in the woods, and support facilities, and so forth. That's my part of the presentation. And Mr. Geisinger, we're not doing this by age still.
You might be. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name again is Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers. Our association is based here in Salem. We represent almost 1,000 small family-owned jobs who are contractors that work in the woods on private lands, state lands, and to a lesser extent on federal lands. As Bob mentioned, 60% of our forests are owned by the federal government. Those lands used to provide over half of the wood fiber that our industry used in the state of Oregon. And today, it's somewhere around 10%. There's a huge opportunity there to address the problem that you're here to discuss today. In 35 years in this business, I don't think I've ever seen a situation that's quite as serious as this one, and the implications so dramatic for the state of Oregon, its communities, and its citizens. And yet the solution is so simple. And that solution is to reconnect revenue to our county governments to the management of our forests. It is that simple. And we're here to support that concept. We know there's a lot of details that have to be dealt with, and the devil's always in the details, but we are here to support the concept of reconnecting county revenues to the management of our forests. I was involved in the political activities that led up to the creation of the Northwest Forest Plan. I sat at the table in 1993, President Clinton's Northwest Forest Conference. Sometimes I've contemplated taking that off of my resume because in hindsight, it's not something I'm particularly proud of. That exercise has been a failure. That plan was to provide a balance of economic, environmental, and social needs, and it's provided one out of the three. The economic and social needs of this state have not been well served by the Northwest Forest Plan, and probably most important, the health of the forest has suffered because of it. The Pacific Northwest Forest and Range Experiment Station just this week released a publication assessing the impact of the Northwest Forest Plan on older forests. It didn't come to any surprise to me that 90% of the older forests that we've lost in Oregon as a result of the Northwest Forest Plan were lost to wildfire. We burn up five times more than was harvested. Now that's not right. And for those of us that live in this area, all we have to do is travel up the San Yam drainage and look at what's happened up there as a result of the mismanagement of our forest that emanated from the Northwest Forest Plan. Something has to change. But the good news is the pendulum doesn't have to move that far to make our industry prosper, to make the communities that depend on it prosper, and to make the county governments whole again from a financial standpoint. We don't have to move back to harvest levels that were in place in the 1980s, and I can defend those, but this isn't the forum to do that. But we don't have to do that. The pendulum doesn't have to move that far to address these very critical issues and to impose a long-term solution to this crisis. But it's going to take some courage, and it's going to take some perseverance on your part and on the governor's part
some special interest groups are going to have to stood up to and told, no, we're not going to do it the way we've been doing it for the last 20 years. We're not going to file lawsuits on the Elliott State Forest that is designated by our Constitution to fund schools. We're not going to stop management on our state forest lands like the Clatsop and the Tillamook that are designated statutorily to fund county trusts. We're not going to do that. Because the Northwest Forest Plan said that if we manage federal lands the way this plan prescribes, we don't have to worry about any threatened species currently listed as of 1994, and the Marble Mural was one of them. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the Clinton administration said if we manage habitat as prescribed in this plan, these species will be okay. So why are we filing lawsuits on state forests that are either constitutionally or statutorily designated for other purpose? That's the kind of thing that people are going to have to stand up to and defend. So let me conclude my remarks by just saying that the contracting community in Oregon is ready to contribute its fair share to restoring the health of our forests. It doesn't matter whether it's timber sales, fuel reduction, streamside habitat improvement, wildlife improvements, or roads improvement. You need independent contractors to do that work, and just like the milling infrastructure, our infrastructure is in danger of eroding to the point that the work that needs to be done won't be done, and I can assure you that there's not a long line of the next generation standing in line to get into this profession unless they can see that there's a future in it, and that is what's at stake in the deliberations today and that we'll be carrying forward as the legislation is introduced that Congressman Schrader, DeFazio, and Waldner are working on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity. Again, Ray Wilkerson, OFIC, and Nancy and I are here today to very briefly let you know that the private forest landowners of Oregon are very concerned about this issue as well. From a narrow self-interest point of view, you might think that it's in our interest not to have a lot of public timber on the market because that makes our logs more valuable. But we're way beyond that sort of narrow thinking because we understand the implications of this issue. And the federal forest issue is the top issue for OFIC. Resolving it is a top issue for all of our members, and it should be for everybody in this room, everybody in the state of Oregon. We have all paid a heavy price for the mismanagement of federal forests over the last 20 years. One of the ways heaviest price we've paid or already been alluded to, that those forests have gradually over 20 years deteriorated to become very unhealthy. That exacerbates problems with fire, insect, and disease issues who don't know any boundaries. The fire doesn't know where the property line is, neither do the bugs. And the federal government is not a good neighbor. One of our board members frequently refers to the federal government as a slum landlord, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. And that puts our private assets at risk. If you've ever been down to Lake and Klamath County and seeing what used to be called the Red Zone, which is thousands and thousands of acres of lodgepole pine killed by beetles on federal land. It's now the gray zone because the needles have all fallen off. But that's just another example of the consequences of mismanagement of federal forests that affects private land as well as public land. The other issue that's already been alluded to is the mill infrastructure, the few mills that are left. Cannot be maintained with private land logs alone. You have to have a mix of public and private. The private land base can't support those mills. That's the reason we have so few mills now compared to what we used to. The rest of them will go away too without a mix of public and private raw material. Good example of that, our second largest member is Forest Capital Partners. They, a few years ago, bought the timberlands formerly owned by Boise Cascade, and a lot of that land's in northeast Oregon, centered in the La Grande area. And the Boise Cascade mills that are still in that area cannot survive just on Forest Capital's timber logs. They've got to have a mix of public and private, or those mills will go away too, and that investment that Forest Capital made in those timberlands is going to become virtually worthless because there's no place for them to market their logs. So wrap up real quick. We're all in this together. We depend on each other. The mill owners can't survive without the landowners. The landowners can't survive without the mill owners. None of us can survive without the contractors. And none of us can survive with the federal government managing their 60% of Oregon's forest the way they're doing it right now. So we encourage you and everybody in the state to get behind us. I think there's momentum now. I think the Congress has finally recognized that doing nothing is not an option, and that's the first step to a solution. We used to cringe every time we opened a newspaper and read the Oregonian editorial
every day, but they've been terrific on this issue. They're urging Congress at every available opportunity to get with the program and solve this problem. So that's encouraging, and anything you can do to help would be much appreciated.
Senator, they save the best to last.
Oh, I hope so. Senator Berger and members of the task force, thank you for swimming here today. I appreciate it. I could just say ditto to everything that Ray said, but maybe you need to hear it from private landowner. Not because I'm a woman, but because I'm part of Small Woodlands, I probably have a more emotional attachment to this, a more emotional presentation. We small woodland owners, a lot of us live on our land, and we're very attached to it. We have groups out to see it and talk to them about healthy forests, and our grandchildren play there, live there. We get caught up in the whole thing of being a landowner and being a good steward of the land. However, we have good stewardship. We have educational classes that we attend. We learn as much as we can. Some of us follow the industrial model. Some of us follow the rural retreat model. But when it comes down to it, there's one thing we don't have, and that's mills. And without mills, we can't survive either. We had our annual meeting in Baker City last year, and we came back from that meeting saddened and appalled, really, at what was going on in the federal forests. I thank God that I don't own any property next to them, because really it smacks of neglect. But I would like to say that, you know, 50 years from now, when people look back at what we did here and not using our common sense, we have some of the best growing timber growing ground on the planet Earth. And we have the premier college of forestry in the world, and yet we're letting our forests burn. We're not taking care of them. I think the solution might be here in this room, and I hope it is. Thank you very much.
We're willing to answer questions. I knew you'd be pleased with that. But on the other hand, I think the second panel is going to talk more about solutions. I think you guys know most about the problems. But if you do have a question about the problem, we'd be happy to answer that. But I would suggest you go to the second panel. But it's up to you.
Thank you very much, Bob. Senator Garai.
Thank you, Co-Chair Berger. I would like to bring up another point that is kind of off the radar, and I think is very important to sell our arguments, being somebody that comes from timber area and is very pro-timber. Right now, the media coverage, you turn on almost any green channel, and they talk about greenhouse gases. And I think the winning argument for harvesting timber is the fact that forest fires contribute between 5 and 10 times all fossil fuels that are burned in this state go up in forest fires that are creating greenhouse gases. Now, the same people that are trying to shut down the forests are the same people that are trying to ignore the greenhouse gas argument. So I'd just like to, if somebody would like to weigh in on that, I think that is an important selling point for the increase in harvest. And you know, you touched on forest fires, but the greenhouse gas emission part of that, I think, is extremely important.
Other questions for the panel? If not, thank you very, very... I'm sorry.
Someone question, Ray. I just want the connection.
Present.
Thank you. One question was regarding the connection of raw logs going overseas and not having availability of mills. It just seems to me that if we actually had those logs being provided to our mills that are here stateside, specifically in Oregon, we'd have a connection of maintaining a value-added product that we could sell, and we'd actually have jobs there in the mills. I'm not sure if I understood that connection of we don't have mills, and so that's why we're forced to take our raw logs off the private lands and put them into foreign areas.
Senator Pozanski, I don't think anyone said that directly, but in response to your question, one of the reasons why a public timber supply component is critical is that the logs from state and private or state and federal lands are not allowed to be exported, so domestic producers can be more competitive in purchasing those logs.
And the export issue, it's cyclical. There was a big spurt of log exports here about a year ago. That's shut off now. So it's kind of, it comes and goes.
But, I just want to clarify that because I wasn't sure if I heard that was
right,
the reason.
Right, right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for your presentation. Now we'll call the second panel, Doug Robertson, Cameron Crouch, Dale Riddle, and Tom Parton.
Go ahead, you start it off.
Who?
You want? I can. Do you?
I think you were on the agenda first.
Because I'd be happy to do that. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the task force. My name is Doug Robertson. I am a county commissioner in Douglas County and also president of the Association of ONC Counties and vice chair of the National Forest Counties and Schools Coalition. I want to begin, Senator Johnson asked a question that sparked a story that I'll recall very briefly about getting into the weeds and mentioning Curry County and their effort, certainly well-intended, to help themselves with a transfer of land. Commissioner Bill Waddle, last fall, from Curry County, was having a cup of coffee across the street from the courthouse. And he finished and stepped outside, and there was a young lady on the sidewalk, and she said, "Excuse me, could you tell me where the courthouse is?" And Bill said, "Yes, actually, it's right across the street." And she said, "Oh, thank you." She said, I'm over here from Jackson County to file a recall petition on all the commissioners because we understand they're trying to swap some park ground for a golf course. When Michael Jordan mentioned political barriers, there are lots of them. And that is in no small way one of the impediments to moving forward on what you're trying to do and what we're trying to do. I don't have to tell you that counties are basically subdivisions of the state. We are your agents to enforce state law and carry out missions like assessment and taxation, elections, public safety, and many, many others. The apocalyptic fiscal tsunami that is coming your way is real. You have heard references to Curry County. That's just one. There are several right behind Curry County. And those services simply have nowhere else to go but back to the state. That's one of the reasons that you're here, certainly one of the reasons we're here. As Bob pointed out, we are here more to talk about solutions, perhaps, than the problems. I think you're all very well aware of the problems. What you perhaps are less aware of is that Curry County doesn't have to become insolvent, nor do any other counties. There is a solution. The solution is in the form of federal legislation. It is in the House Resources Committee as we speak, and it does a myriad of things. While we have not seen the bill, nor has anybody else at this point, we, along with those others on the panel, many of whom you've heard from, have worked particularly over the last 8 to 10 months, almost daily, on fashioning this piece of legislation. It does a lot of things. Let me mention five very quickly. The first and perhaps most important is jobs. If you talk to any politician, community leader, economist, the way out of this mess we're in is to create jobs. The ONC part of this piece of legislation proposes to create somewhere in the neighborhood of 12,000 new jobs upon full implementation. Those are direct jobs, and you know what the multiplier is for indirect jobs. Secondly, a predictable and sustainable flow of raw material for the wood products industry. If they are going to continue to be in business, and the reference was made earlier by Ray Wilkinson about infrastructure, the infrastructure of this industry in our communities is absolutely essential. Once it's gone, and Senator Ferrioli knows this as well as anybody, once it's gone, it doesn't come back. And we have lost a lot of it. We simply can't afford to lose any more. Thirdly, a sustainable flow of resources to counties so we can continue to provide the services that is our obligation. And this bill provides those resources at an adequate level for us to do that. The fourth thing, increasing forest health. There have been significant concessions made to the conservation community, which is certainly part of this discussion that has to be addressed. There are issues dealing with wilderness. There are issues dealing with management of older timber, protection of old growth that are embedded in this piece of legislation that we feel is very balanced. And lastly, I would mention the relief of the federal government on a tremendous fiscal responsibility that they now have to manage these lands. Every year, the Western Oregon BLM spends $105 million to manage the ONC lands in Western Oregon. That obligation would go away as the transfer of management goes from the federal government, basically under the State Oregon Forest Practices Act. In addition to that, $400 million, give or take, a year for secure rural schools, by and large, would go away as well. So the federal government also has a significant benefit as it relates to this. Madam Chair, you asked a question about dedicated money, what flexibilities are there, and so on. The reason that we are so focused on the ONC lands, particularly in Western Oregon, is because those funds for the counties are discretionary. That is how many of us run county government. Douglas County historically has had 65-70% of its general fund come from ONC receipts or, more recently, secure rural school dollars. There is no replacement for that money for us or for the other counties that receive it. The other portion of the money, and this is dealt with in Title I of the legislation, is the Forest Service. Forest Service dollars that come to the county are dedicated. They can only be used for schools, roads, and bridges. And so can we change that? Yes. There is some reluctance for good reason to do that. Some counties, ours being one of them, has made some modifications to that. So that perhaps is something to look at. But the dedicated nature of the Forest Service dollars and the discretionary nature of the ONC dollars is something that's very important to understand. And also the importance of those road dollars to the counties. Many counties, and again ours being one of them, are looking at the inevitability of pavement turning back into gravel simply because we can't afford the upkeep. Many of those county roads access the national forest, and that obviously is going to cause problems. Finally, in conclusion, in terms of a request, we recognize that you haven't seen this bill. We also recognize that your efforts in terms of the task force is to look at state possibilities in helping and backfilling county services and so on. We would ask that this committee, this task force, as the legislation becomes apparent and is made public, that your efforts will evolve into looking at the real solution to this problem, which is management of our federal forest lands. You know more about it, perhaps, than many of your colleagues because of the effort that you have spent getting the information that you have before us. So as that bill comes out and we are hopeful that it will be early in February that we see it. Our hope would be that you simply evolve into a discussion about hopefully your ability to support that legislation and urge the governor to do so as well. It was also mentioned that we have an unprecedented situation that we've never had before on a piece of legislation of this importance both to the state and to the counties, and that is bipartisan support on the congressional level for a bill. And make no mistake about it, Congressman DeFazio, Congressman Walden, and Congressman Schrader support this entire bill. And that is, again, it's unprecedented. It sends a clear message that it's time to do something. And I think you know that, and we know that. So thank you very much for your time.
Senator Verger, members of this task force, I really appreciate you having this hearing today. My name is Tom Parton. I'm president of the American Forest Resource Council. We're a regional trade association of forest products producers, and our members need a good balance of federal timber and private timber lands throughout the state here in Oregon, and that's why we're here today to talk about our federal forests. First of all, I want to thank you for holding this hearing. I think it's very important. It's probably one of the most important things that our state is facing right now. The answers and the solutions have to come out not only for our state, but for our Oregon forests, for our Oregon counties, and for our Oregon rural communities. So this is a very important issue. These are not new problems that we're facing. These are problems that we've had for the last 20 years. I think we've kicked the can down the road, but I think now is the time to address the situation and address the problems and find some solutions. And I strongly believe that the options that we're going to point out today and what we bring to the table as far as the forest products community, as far as the forests and what they have to answer are really the solutions, and I hope you look at them, and I hope you look at the issues that we present. My job today, Cameron's going to talk a little bit about the ONC lands. My job today is to point out why we need to have some better management on our national forests and find the solutions to the catastrophes facing our counties right now. I want to bring my perspective as what I'm going to talk about, not only as an association executive, but I lived for 50 years on the east side of Oregon. I lived in Prineville. I lived for 18 years in John Day. I managed a sawmill. I managed Malheur Lumber Company for John Shelk for a number of years. I worked with Ted on many, many issues when he chaired Malheur Timber Operators. I used the federal forest. We needed the federal forest to find a job over there. And I watched as our community, 2 years of which I was mayor, shrivel up. I watched Grant Western Lumber Company shut down. I watched Prairie Wood Products shut down. I watched the big facility in Burns, Hines, shut down, Snow Mountain Pine. I watched Ellingson Lumber Company shut down. I watched Blue Mountain Forest Products and Long Creek shut down. And it's not easy to do that. It's something that I want to turn the tide and do something different. The national forests in Oregon represent or own about 14.2 million acres, 47% of the state's timberland. In eastern Oregon and southwest Oregon, where we have the biggest problems, some of those counties are 80% owned, have 80% federal timberland ownership in them, and it's a big issue. Any solution to our rural counties has to include better management of our national forests, to sell more timber, to create more jobs, indirect and direct jobs both, and return timber receipts back to our counties and keep valuable services flowing the way it used to be. And I will call it the good old days. It's not the good old days, it was the practical days. Our federal government had a contract with rural America. They don't pay taxes on those lands. They had a contract to manage the lands, to cut timber, and bring timber receipts back to those counties. Our federal government has broken that contract with rural America, and it's high time that we get back and we start implementing that contract. You know, there's been several efforts over the last 20 years that I've participated in to try to find a solution. When Governor Kitzhaber served in his first term, he had the Eastside Forest Health Advisory Panel. We spent 6 years going over possible solutions. We even set up the Blue Mountain Demonstration Area, which was 1.5 million acres of forest land in eastern Oregon. We didn't get one project off of that. We didn't get one stick of timber, but at least it was a recognition that we had a problem over there and we needed to do something different. As already been brought up today, Governor Kulongowski had the Federal Forest Advisory Committee. Many people in this room, including Bill Cluding, was there every month. AFRC testified every month. We tried to bring solutions to the table. The solutions are better management of our ONC timberlands and our national forests, and we've just got to get there. This is a two-decade-old problem looking for a solution, and I think we have the solution, and I'm going to walk through some of our points that I want to make on this. But it's been described, what we have now from Congressman Hastings is just a discussion draft out there. It's got Title I. It outlines some of the solutions on the national forests. We are waiting for a Title II. There's been a lot of work going on that behind the scenes. We don't know exactly what that will be, but I want to address what some of the issues are in the Title I portion of it. We have to start back here and retrace history. And I don't care how you look at it, but when you go from a 5 billion foot harvest of our federal timberlands in 1989 down to less than 1 billion in a 3-year term, that's a killer. That's a killer not only for our industry, it's a killer for the counties, and it's a killer for the state. And in my opinion, for 20 years, we've tried to mask that 4 billion foot drop in federal timber and by doing it different ways. We've said that tourism and recreation are going to take care of our rural communities. We've done it by handing out dollars to the counties, and those dollars are running out, and we've got to look at a new solution. I want to run through just the forest products industry over four decades. This is where we were in 1980. We had 405 mills open. We had total mill employment of over 45,000 people. We started getting into the listing of the spotted owl and some endangered species during the decade of the 80s to the 90s. We had some reduction in our forest products industry. In 1990, we reduced from 45,000 employment down to 36,000, almost 37,000. So we'd had a minor reduction. It was going in a negative trend. And I want to bring up one important fact. When we start talking about employment in the forest sector, we also have to talk about the indirect jobs. And the indirect jobs are sometimes more, one or one and a half times more than the direct jobs. So we're talking about a huge amount of jobs for the state of Oregon. Okay, between 1990 and 2000, we had the Northwest Forest Plan, which Jim Geisinger talked about, and we also had the East Side Screens that virtually crippled Ted Ferrioli's district in eastern Oregon. That's why we had all of the sawmills drop out, because we couldn't cut any trees over 21 inches, which we still can't. I've got to drop back up to one. So in 2000, we went from 45,000 employment down to 23. It basically cut our employment in half, and we went from 405 or 406 mills down to 175. That was a decade of ruin, in my opinion, and it started the trend, and this trend is continuing. We'll look at 2010. Currently, we have 106 mills open. We have a total mill employment of 15,000. These are slides that Congressman Walden put together in some of his testimony. It's all summed up in this. Today we have 106 mills open. We've lost 299. We have a mill employment back in 1980 of 45,000. Currently we've lost two-thirds of that, and we're down to 15,000. That's a tell of the tape on what's happened with the reduction of our federal forest harvest. Nothing more, nothing less. Our state private timberland harvest have remained static. It all goes back to that first slide about what we've lost in our federal timber harvest. I want to go through an example on the Malheur Forest. Ted and I are very, very familiar with this, and it's what happened. When I went over to John Day in 1983, we were cutting 228 million board feet, and using a factor of 18.5 direct and indirect jobs per million board feet, for Wheeler, Grant, Umatilla counties, we were employing 4,166 people in the forest products industry and direct jobs and secondary jobs. Okay, let's fast forward now to 2000 and 2010. We're cutting a whopping total on the mill here of 21.8 million board feet. That'll sustain maybe 403 jobs. So we've got a net loss in those four county areas, basically, and also the secondary jobs that's produced in Portland and the metropolitan areas to provide the high-tech issues for those jobs, steel, oil, those kind of products. We've lost 3,763 jobs just in that one little working area. Think about all of the small communities where we had harvests on our federal timber of good numbers, and that's the total amount of jobs we've lost, as pointed out in Congressman Walden's chart. We talked about what's left in the east side. These are the mills left in the east side. And the point I want to make here is there's 10 of them, as it's been previously mentioned. Look at them. They're surrounded by islands of green. Those are national forests. Those national forests are not producing. The 10 mills left are limping along. They're holding on by their fingernails. And as the private landowners mentioned, they need those mills as much as the communities need the mills. So we have to protect those. We have to get these forests going. We have to make sure we don't lose any more infrastructure on the east side. Let's look at a solution. Part of what this bill is dealing with, the discussion draft brings out the modest increases of harvest that we'd have to make this work. And to reach the harvest needed to generate the 2008 Secure Rural Schools numbers on the Malheur National Forest, we only need 77.9 million board feet. Right now on that forest, the annual growth is 362 million. The annual mortality is 95 million. So to get to where we need to balance our payments to the counties, we only need to cut 35% of the annual growth, and we only need to cut 82% of the annual mortality. That's not overstepping. That's not even good management. But that's all we need to get back and make our counties whole. That's an east side issue, an east side example. A west side example. Somebody's going to have to help me here because I fouled up and I can't get it to fast forward. But I want to talk about the Rogue Siskiyou. It's another forest where we have basically growing over a billion board feet. Growing over a billion board feet, what we need to generate the 2008 Secure Rural Schools payments is basically 107 million. That's only 11% of the forest growth, and it's only 41% of the annual mortality. Again, that's not even good forestry. We shouldn't even be talking about numbers that low. We should be talking about better management, but that's the modest increase we need to get our forests where they need to be and our county payments where they need to be. I want to use, because the legislation has talked about the trust concept, maybe using a trust, let's look at our neighbor to the north. The Washington DNR manages a sparse 2.2 million acres. And on that 2 million acres, for the decade of 2000 to 2010, they averaged each year 566 million. They brought in revenue of 168 million or $308 per MBF. Let's take a switch and look at the national forests in Washington State that aren't a trust concept, that are limping along doing very little. Those Washington national forests, they're 9.3 million acres compared to 2.2. Last year they sold a total of 129 million board feet. They brought in a total of $650,000 in revenue, which averaged $5 per thousand board feet. Compare $5,000 to the $308 per thousand board feet that the trust concept makes, and you can find where the dollars are to support your counties. Let's look at the trust concept. Let's look at putting some forests into this and manage them in that manner. The last couple of things I'll touch on real quickly. We have to focus on sawlogs. Sawlogs is the driver of this. We talk a lot about biomass. The dollars aren't there for biomass. Sawlog, lumber component of this, you can average $300 plus. Biomass is way down, maybe $10, $15, with sawdust, shavings, wood chips in between. So our discussions and our focus have to be on sawlogs. The final thing, this is a map of Oregon with the condition class 2 and 3 lands. We're waiting for a disaster to happen. We're on borrowed time. Last year, the last 2 years, we've had wet seasons. We haven't had the fires. That's not going to happen long term. We're going to lose. We either have to manage our forests, get the dollars out of them, or they're going to go up in smoke. So, Madam Chairwoman, thank you for your time, and I'll pass it on to Cameron.
Hi, Cameron Krause with Swanson Group. I'll just really quickly finish off this discussion about the forest issue or the forestry component. Doug touched on ONC, Tom started on Forest Service. I will say there is a discussion draft for everybody to look at. I hope you've all seen it that Doc Hastings has, which is Title I that deals with the Forest Service. You're going to hear a lot about ONC in Oregon. Of course, ONC is only in Oregon. We're the only ones with that land base. It's about, even in the western counties, it's about half of what those counties have received. The other half is from Forest Service receipts. Title I deals specifically with those receipts. The numbers that Tom showed for Malheur, the Malheur National Forest and the Rogue Siskiyou are basically extrapolations from that discussion draft. So I think there's going to be a lot of criticism of that draft that it's extreme. And I think when you look at these numbers, it's pretty easy to say, no, it's not extreme. It's a reasonable solution. It does use a trust concept. It establishes a trust obligation on behalf of the Secretary of Agriculture. He has to produce a certain amount of revenue for the counties. The projects that he uses to produce that revenue get expedited authorities, so you don't get your $5 per thousand that they get using current authorities. The reason you're only getting $5 is because of the analysis, litigation fear of the agencies has driven them to do very, very little on acres, and it produces no revenue. So I think the DNR example shows that if you were able to free up that management on a certain portion of the acres, you could produce the revenue. So lastly, I just want to touch for a second on what I think the legislature in Oregon can do. I think we've seen with Governor Kitzhaber much more engaged on the forest issue and recognizing it. I think the legislature has a role to play there as well. However you guys could do that, you're better at that than me. You have a voice. It's important, and I will say when we go to D.C. for the last 10 years that I've been doing this, we're often asked, well, where's the state? And we kind of look behind us, and there isn't anybody there, and that's a tough argument to make. And I think it's time that you step up as a legislature when the time's right, look at the bills, make sure they do provide the management certainty and the revenue that is needed to solve this problem, because like Representative Hanna said, it is easy to solve. It's a pretty easy solution, so it's frustrating we're even here. But I hope you guys look at them and express through resolutions or whatever you can do your strong support for active forest management to fix the problem. So that's all I have. I don't want to be repetitive. So,
thank you very much. Fascinating presentation, I have to tell you. I want to go back to you, Doug. Tell me a little bit again about the timeline on this bill, and when will we see a bill, and how, if the legislature or legislators would choose, or this task force would choose, to be supportive and be a little bit more specific?
I wish I could be really specific, but I'll do my best. The bill that has been described is in more than draft form, but there are still some loose ends that are being worked on. It is the hope of the Resources Committee in the House of Representatives to get this bill out of committee, get it marked up and through the House by mid-February. So hopefully by the first week in February, we will all see the bill. Number one. The bill then, of course, there is every reason to believe it was going to go through the House, will go to the Senate. That is a different set of dynamics that, again, we will hopefully be working together to provide information and encouragement for our United States senators to take this up. We are in almost constant conversation with both Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley and their staff on this issue. The other moving part in this, of course, and you are all aware of Senator Wyden's efforts with Senator Baucus, chair of the Finance Committee for Montana, for a short-term reauthorization of some kind so that counties that are facing insolvency and more serious problems can get through that point in time until there is a long-term solution. On February 28th, the tax extender bill and the payroll tax extension expires. As we look at things today, it appears that that is the only piece of federal legislation moving that can be counted on. There may be something more. There's talk, of course, about budget and farm bill and a host of other things. But right now, there is reason to believe that that piece of legislation will move. That anything that moves is a potential for this bill to be inserted or some form of short-term reauthorization. So by the end of February, we are going to have a much clearer picture of what Congress is going to do with this issue. And, of course, that's going to be the driving force. But hopefully, by the first or second week in February, we will all see the bill so that when we ask for your support, you can say, well, rather than I'd love to support it, but I need to see it first, you'll have an opportunity to go through it. Everybody that's testified before you today will, of course, make themselves available to answer questions and do whatever we can to clarify the issues. It is not an uncomplicated piece of legislation, as Cameron Krause can tell you, having worked on it for 10 months with staff members and principals in the House. But it is a very comprehensive, well-thought-out, well-reasoned, balanced piece of legislation. So that's as best I can do with time frame.
Co-Chair Hammond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, in as few words as you can, because I have a follow-up question, define forest mortality.
Forest mortality is actually trees that are dying maybe because of fire, insect, and disease, but basically it's material that is dead and dying.
Thank you. May I follow up, Madam Chair?
Absolutely.
So, if I look at this slide, would it be fair to say that 250% more board footage is dying than it would take to harvest to reach the 2008 level? I mean, am I reading the numbers correctly? We're losing 260 million board feet. It would only take 107. So we're allowing close to 250% more material to die than it would take to reach the 2008 funding level.
That's exactly right. And we're not only getting the dollars, but we're still creating a problem because we have that dead biomass that's able to accumulate out there, and at some point we're going to have a big fire.
Madam Chair, I'm asking you to be brief because I'm not trying to take the time here, but do you know of any forest management plan that prescribes that type of management? I mean, is there a school of forestry that says
that's almost a loaded question, I think. But I'm going to go back and use a term that Ray Wilkerson did, and that's a slum landlord. And basically, that's not management. That's a hands-off approach. That's a hands-off approach using many excuses that we have lawsuits, that we don't have funding, that we have this problem or we have that problem. We've got to get away from that. We have got to insist that this agency manage their lands.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that a little bit because we've just had some appeals down in my part of the world on something that happened that we thought was pretty good. What do we do to keep people from our groups from putting it into the court? You know, anybody can sue for any reason. And so how do you negotiate that?
Well, I think there's some tools that the Forest Service has using the HFRA process, expediting projects. I think one of the clauses in the discussion draft, the Hastings bill, actually calls for no appeals or limited appeals, where we actually take projects, they are put out in place, people get a chance to review them, they're good solid projects, and they should move forward. There is the ability to litigate right now. It is causing a problem. I think our society needs to look at that because it's really blocking what needs to happen on our public timberlands.
Senator Przanski?
Thank you. Doug, could you follow up on what you were talking about on the timeline? What I heard you say is that by the end of February, we kind of know where the federal legislation is going to be. Has there been any projection? I know you're asking to look in a crystal ball, but how quickly would that legislation move forward? And the reason I want to know that is because I need to figure out when will we, as a task force, have a next opportunity to be able to weigh in and give that support that you want.
Senator, that's a very good question, and one that's very difficult to answer. The getting the bill out of the House so that we all see what's in it is number one. And then, frankly, building support for passage is going to determine the second part of your question to a large extent. There will be an opportunity during the course of the spring and summer, hopefully, for the two committees of jurisdiction either to come together in a conference or find a piece of legislation that's moving for either one or both of those. So really, the answer is how much interest can we generate in our congressional delegation, which is very engaged at this point, to move this into a point where there is legislation scheduled.
So, and if I could just follow up.
Follow up.
Madam Chair, I believe our next legislative week would be set in May, and so we would have that opportunity to have that before us, and we can be briefed before that and actually have it on the agenda.
Hopefully.
Okay.
That'd be great. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Perio.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If you'll indulge me for just a second. As I look at the folks in this audience, I've worked with almost everyone here on this problem over the last 20 years, and I'd just like to share a little perspective on it. We've been having this conversation since the 1980s, when Andy Stahl and Andy Kerr and a half a dozen other folks sort of helped to morph the anti-war movement into the pro-environmental movement. And in doing that, they also discovered the supremacy of the Endangered Species Act. But I'd like to add something that I don't think any of the panelists feel at liberty to say. From that day to this day, the congressional delegations have pandered to the ecosystem radicals. And I mean all over the West, it's been amazing to see various congressional delegations from time to time encouraging a green vote, and certainly it's happened nationally. And our problem is we don't have the critical mass of citizens in any one of our states, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, any of the Intermountain West, to overcome a nationalization of this environmental issue. So we have lost control of the issue. The problem there is that we keep, as state legislators, not only have our congressional delegations pandered to the green side, but state legislators have ceded the field to Congress, which has been completely co-opted during the debate on this issue. And I got to tell you, this isn't an ONC lands issue. You know, it is not a coastal counties problem. It isn't a anything that can be limited to one region or the other of the Intermountain West. It's a system-wide collapse of federal management of the national forests and the BLM forests and the ONC lands. It's a system-wide collapse of the management model that we're currently using for those forests. I think we can resolve the issue, but we need a short-term in lieu of extension, you know, and that is not a management model. It's a free admission that we have failed to manage our lands. The in lieu of is in lieu of the jobs, in lieu of management, in lieu of a sustainability model, which is called for in the law. But right now, we're so close to collapse on some of our Oregon counties. Not all, I will tell you, on the South Coast. Some of the interior counties are just as close to collapse of their road funds, school funds, and other funds. So it's a statewide problem, and I think it belongs to the legislature to solve. The solution that we have to have is the short-term extension, but we also have to stop incentivizing the litigation process. And Oregon provides a strong financial incentive for nonprofit corporations to litigate. We accord them a nonprofit status because they take advantage of the 501c3 regulations at the federal and the state level. And so what we're doing in the state of Oregon is actually providing a safe haven for corporations, shell corporations, who really only house litigators, and they sort of masquerade as folks who are doing charitable education or fraternal organizational work, when really all they do is litigate and raise money. You know, they're fundraisers and litigators, and we accord them the tax status that allows them to continue to operate in Oregon. And we also allow folks not to be accountable to citizens in local communities, but to this nebulous concept of other publics that are, you know, just over the horizon. And the children and the families of the folks that live in the, on the landscape really depend on the state legislator and their congressional delegation to push back and make the decisions that are going to prevent class warfare from extirpating communities. And we've watched it all through the Intermountain West, and it's continuing today, and it now threatens to collapse the institutions and the governments that we depend on to deliver the services. So what do we do, you know, as legislators? We've sort of seeded this whole issue. Oh, it's congressional, our hands are tied, whatever. Well, here's what we need to do. We need to carefully review the 501c3 status of corporations to see if they really are fraternal, educational, or charitable. And if they don't have a charity and they don't have a state recognized curriculum and they're not providing direct services to people, they aren't a 501c3 and don't deserve a tax exempt status in Oregon. And if they litigate in Oregon, that provides a nexus for us to look at their national operations to tax those national operations, because they're really not a nonprofit entity. That's something that legislators could do to get at the root of the problem, which is an incentive for litigation. The other thing we really need to do is make sure that Oregon legislators stand up and demand a stewardship relationship to manage the forest land base that is first Oregon forest before it's any other forest, before it's any other land ownership. And whether that's a trust relationship or the state of Oregon demanding a stewardship arrangement with the BLM and the Forest Service, which we've talked about a lot but done very little to do, these stewardship contracts are supposedly available on large tracts of land. And we have the mechanisms and the means to manage through the Oregon Department of Forestry and the State Board of Forestry. And I will put the record of management on any state forest or private land under the Oregon Forest Practices Act in comparison with any federal land anywhere, and you can clearly see that the forests managed in accountability to the citizens of the state of Oregon are healthy and thriving, and the ones who are accountable to the other publics of the nation are exceeding mortality. Mortality is exceeding growth. So I guess what I'm telling you is, the thing I don't think panelists feel free to say, is that the real problem in this equation is the state legislator who cedes the issue to somebody else and the congressional delegation who looks at a national issue and sees a green vote as being more influential than taking care of the folks at home. That's the real problem here. And it's going to persist until Oregon legislators stand up and say, we've had enough of this. We're not going to watch counties collapse, and we're not going to watch the continuation of whole communities which are going to die imminently without strong action from this body and our congressional delegation. So, you know, my perspective is we've had this conversation since 1984. There's real clear indications about what needs to happen. The real actors that have been sidelined are state legislators who are not being held accountable or not holding themselves accountable to manage Oregon forests for Oregon citizens. So other than that, I have no real strong feelings about this issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other than that, you're not passionate about anything.
No, ma'am.
Other questions? Thank you so much. We really appreciate your being here, and I hope that you have recognized the attentiveness upon which you have been received by this committee. So.
Thank you.
Committee, are there any other comments? Yes, Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I think it would be very helpful for the committee to know what's going to be our schedule of meetings. I know that leadership, in some cases, the chairs of the committee have met with different groups, but when is the committee going to continue our deliberations? Will we meet regularly during the February session?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, we are adjourning from here to have that very discussion. Currently, we are having conversation around when we will get the first view, as many have asked, of the federal legislation. Secondly, we're going to have a discussion around what action items, if any, are available for us that tend to be more how would we help in the event of insolvency, and what those issues might be in terms of things Michael Jordan discussed in terms of flexibility of funding and those types of things. So we will be back to you from my perspective, and I think from our co-chair's perspective, within the day or so to say here's the idea, but we are open for
any suggestions.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
One suggestion that I would make is that there seem to be a growing number of bills, individual member bills, that speak to some of these issues. And I think it would be very helpful if staff on behalf of this committee could gather those bills, and we would at least have a chance to review them in this forum and to see whether or not this committee would want to lend our support to individual member bills that speak to some of the potential solutions that have been postulated previously but certainly were offered today.
Good idea.
As one of the co-chairs, I would agree that that's a great idea, and I think we'll report it.
It is a good idea. Thank you, Senator Johnson. That's and I have seen a couple of bills as well. Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the co-chairs, as you schedule, one question, and I believe I heard Representative Hanna say this, that we're going to continue looking at what we will do should the federal government not do the right thing. I graduated from college in 1987. From there till now, the federal forest harvest is down 90%. And in my working years, I have heard repeatedly the solution of problems in Oregon is when the federal government does the right thing, we will do X, Y, and Z. And I, for one, ran for the legislature because I'm tired of waiting for the federal government to do the right thing. I don't think it's prudent for us to assume the federal government will do the right thing. And so in that regard, as hard as it is and as distasteful as it is, we have got to actually start tasking what we will do should the federal government not do the right thing, and then be able to publicize that to let our constituencies and let the constituencies of Senator Merkley and Senator Wyden know what is coming should those senators not do the right thing. Because at the end of the day, isn't that really what this task force is about, Madam Chair?
Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up on that. The reason I made the comment earlier about jurisdiction, number one, it's true. And number two, there's a lot of states' rights issues in here. And we have been frustrated in this state over all the time I have been in this building of federal jurisdiction over what constitutionally is a states' rights issue. And we have yet to be willing to voice a challenge on that level. And I do think that that we need to look at the jurisdictional issue here and see what rights we actually have as a state of Oregon to dictate some of the policy as far as timber harvest.
Other comments? I think on the positive side, I think we have a number of legislators, and those of you sitting here at the dais, that are taking this extremely seriously. And I think also we have a congressional delegation that are willing to really go to bat for us. It's far more complicated, and all of you know that, when you try to get legislation passed at the federal level. We are a small state. We have dedicated people there, but the political climate in D.C. at this time does not encourage many of us to think optimistically about some things happening, not necessarily this. But I think that we are going to meet, as Co-Chair Hanna said, and we're going to be working on some of the options and things that we can bring back to you as a committee. Thank you very much for your very, very nice attention to the presenters today. And with that, unless there's no other business to come before the body, I will call the meeting adjourned.